My guest today, Professor Pedro Lanchurian, is chair of the Department of Latin American Studies at the University of San Francisco, specializing in Latin American contemporary narrative and critical theory. His academic areas of specialization include Latin American literature and culture, film studies, urban studies, comparative literature, and critical theory, particularly psychoanalytic theory. He has co-authored and co-edited a book, Postmodernity in Latin America, a Reader, and his article in this volume has been singled out as an important contribution in understanding the neo-Baroque aesthetic in Latin America and its relation to the global discourse on postmodernity. Professor Lanchurian, Lanchurian has also written and directed a number of films, one of which, Visitas, a full-feature narrative film that explores violence in Colombia, was an official selection in international festivals, among them Montreal, Toronto, Austin, Chicago, Granada, Brussels, Fribourg, and Cartagena. He's also a native of Venezuela, where his parents still reside. We met in San Francisco recently, and after discussing the situation in his country, I suggested he come on Takes on the World and share his thoughts with you. Welcome, Pedro Lanchurian, to Takes on the World. I'm glad to have you with us here today. While many, if not most, of my listeners have been sympathetic with developments in Venezuela since the emergence of Hugo Chavez as its president in 1999, I'd like to begin with finding out what the country was like before that and what was its relations with the United States.
For Hugo Chavez, the country for a long time, say between 1958 until 1983, enjoyed relatively good relationships with the United States, partly because the country was fueling the oil needed because of the energy crisis after the war and so on. There was a sort of democratic system which alternated itself between two parties, a party based on syndicates, that was Acción Democrática, and a more conservative party, that was COPEI. But in 1983, a kind of overvalued currency was devalued, and that was the beginning of Venezuelans' economic maladies. So that was in 1983. In 1989, Carlos Andrés Pérez, who is the president that Chavez tried to depose through a coup, was reelected. He was elected in 1988, and he had promised not to give in to the exigencies or demands of the Monetary International, of the IMF, right? But he did. Immediately after he was in power. And one of the first things he did was to raise the price of oil, of gas. Mind you, in Venezuela, gas is very cheap. It's cheapest in the world. You can fill a tank with 10 cents to this day. And that, of course, unleashed a wave of protest and looting in Venezuela in 1989, which was called El Caracazo. That instability prompted the impeachment of the president, who was also charged with corruption. So he was democratically impeached. And that basically left a power vacuum in the country that allowed for the emergence of Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez in 1992 tried to depose this president through a failed coup d'etat. He was jailed for 2 years and then he was pardoned by President Caldera. And after that, there was a deep power vacuum. The traditional political parties have been discredited, and Venezuelans were looking for a solution, and Chavez formed a party. It was like a two-year-old party, really, called Movimiento Quinta República, which translates as Fifth Republic Movement. And the fifth is because everything before Chavez was known as the Fourth Republic. And he won the elections with a wide, wide margin. Now, his political position was centrist, leftist at that point. So that's the kind of background of how Chavez came to power and the sort of conditions the country was. But the relationship with the United States were amicable. the United States, you know, always tried to, through its economic might, to sort of frustrate attempts in Venezuela for economic sovereignty. And you can argue that these political, these traditional political parties, or the elites of these traditional political parties and the sort of oligarchical base of the country that supported them were in cahoots with American interest at the time.
So now, so one of the things that, of course, made an impression upon Americans was when Chavez came into power, his embrace of Cuba, which was flew in the face of U.S. policy, and his actually, I remember going to the United States, into the U.N., quoting Noam Chomsky.
Yeah, exactly.
How much support did his position on Cuba have among the Venezuelan people? And was that an important issue for them? I know Cubans sent many doctors into Venezuela. But how was that seen? Was there protest against him being too pro-Castro, or did they not care as long as it didn't affect their economic situations?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question, right? Because, I mean, his allegiance to Cuba, though he was always sympathetic to Fidel Castro, and actually didn't know him until well into the late 90s, 1990s, even the year 2000, I can't say exactly. But his sympathy with and his allegiance with Cuba comes after the opposition, along with foreign aid, tried to orchestrate a coup d'etat against Chavez. This was in 2001. So something parallel to what happened in Cuba, right? He was ideologically kind of undefined until he had to take a position. And that's when the sort of relationship with Cuba became very close and very entrenched. And the country at that point was very polarized. So you had an opposition that was anti-Cuba, anti-Castro, has always been anti-Cuba and anti-Castro. But Chavez had gained not only a lot of acceptance after the coup, but he sort of intensified the Bolivarian revolution along the lines of the revolution in Cuba. So he made, at that point, because the country was flooded with cash from oil revenues, he was able to make significant changes in poverty. So poverty decreased. There were a lot of social projects and that he instituted. His famous misiones that touch on education, on housing, on self-governance, all these models were exported from Cuba. One of the things he did, for instance, was support the Cuban state, you know, and the Cuban Revolution, which has been under an embargo for years, by sending Cuba 53,000 gallons of oil a day. That increased in later years, right? And Cuba, in exchange, sent doctors to Venezuela. Now, the interesting thing here is that Venezuela, during the 70s had and the 80s, had an enviable healthcare system. So what Chavez did was he sort of eroded and almost ruined the health system that was in place in the country because it was identified with the social programs of the Fourth Republic and instituted this famous Misión Barrio Adentro, which was very good, but one came at the cost or at the expense of the other. But it was very well received, and there were strides. I mean, there was a lot of success in the misiones while the country had money. And this became kind of a pattern. He would use the money from all revenues to fuel campaigns, to unleash all kinds of social projects right before the elections. And this is a way in which he did politics within the country, outside of the country as well. I mean, the so-called oil diplomacy. But I think, in a sense, that was very positive, right? Because for the first time in a long time in Latin America, we had someone who was very vocal about offering an alternative different from neoliberalism. And, you know, there was a wave of governments in Latin America led by Chavez. I mean, he was the main figure, like Lula da Silva in Brazil and Evo Morales in Bolivia and Correa in Ecuador and the Kirchner in Argentina, who leaned to the left. Having said that, there are vast and huge differences among those leftist projects in these countries.
And all of them have shown to have feet of clay. They have more, say, external support from leftists around the world than they do from the people they're supposed to be serving in their respective countries at this point in time.
Yeah, I mean, but if you look, for instance, at the case of, I mean, let's do a bit of comparative politics here. If you look at the case of Evo Morales in Bolivia, well, I represented the indigenous contingency in Bolivia, which is significant. He comes from a grassroots movement, and he has adopted economic policies that have been very sound. Bolivia now has 1 or 2% inflation as compared to Venezuela that has 200%. You can imagine the sort of nightmarish lives Venezuelans live day by day with that kind of inflationary rate. The same thing with goes for Argentina. Now, Chavez forged alliances among these countries. He sort of revolutionized the more alternative media by creating this collective channel called Telesur. He did these wonderful things, but the sort of economic base of it made them unsustainable. And if you look at the country now, if you look at the Misiones now, most of them are broken. The only one that is still kind of working is the housing mission. By Misiones, I mean social projects. But Barrio Adentro, which was the healthcare social project initiated by Chavez, is broken, is bankrupt. The many of the universities he created are also bankrupt.
Well, this was the source of his support among the Venezuelan people. We've read, of course, here in the mainstream media, the clashes of class warfare within Venezuela, with even the unions opposing Chavez policies. How accurately was that reported here? It seems like there was a... you had real divisions in which Chavez was counting on really the poor to back him up and maintain him in office.
Yeah, I mean, I think is that correct, and I think that can be explained by the fact that Chavez is a populist, but a particular type of populist that is, inherent to Latin American culture. He's a caudillo. And basically, caudillo is a strong, charismatic leader with a populist program of reforms that appeals to a broad base, and his allure on people depends on personality cult. We've had examples of caudillos in Latin America, almost in every country, and the Latin American literature, even the one written by Nobel Prize winners, they all have somehow written novels on these sort of cultural figures. So Chavez's appeal was a direct appeal to the people, and mostly after 2001, which was the coup, and 2004, in which a referendum contemplated within the Venezuelan constitution to depose and elect another president if there is not enough popular support, the 2004 referendum was, you know, showed that Chavez had wide support among the lower and working classes, and then the country became very polarized. The unions, the syndicates, he actually did everything in his power to undermine them. One of the general strike launched in Venezuela right after the coup was launched by the United Workers Union of Venezuela, which was an institution that was born or that emerged out of the main syndicalist party in the country, which has now pretty much disappeared. So the unions were not with him. What Chavez did, which was very smart, you see, he would from a political point of view, he would destroy or annul or undermine institutions related to the Fourth Republic, including the unions, and create his own. Even against popular opinion and popular choice. Like, for instance, in internal elections, people elected one election after 2004 in which people elected governments and representatives, particularly governors of states, and overwhelming majority of them were non-Chavistas, right? Were from the opposition. So what Chavez did was amend the constitution to create another figure, the vice president. Venezuela had four vice presidents, and the state governors were under the vice president, so they would never have access to federal funding, you see. This is the way he worked. He worked within, he used democracy rather than to what he wanted to do. More than being a sort of democratic leader. He used the democratic system in order to carry on with his project.
Well, today there's even estimates that the inflation rate is up to 800%. And how did the economy become a basket case? I mean, sitting on this huge oil wealth, still selling oil to the United States, whose fault was this? Was it, it began with Chavez? Was it just total mismanagement, or were his goals too big?
I think, probably both. Probably his goals were too big, and they were perhaps the product of an ego that became increasingly inflated as time went on. And, you know, I was sympathetic to the sort of political change Chavez brought to the Latin American landscape, but after a while you couldn't agree with what he was doing. The country was extremely militarized. There was not meritocracy. There was a huge nepotism. People were handling economic institutions military people were handling economic institutions, and even companies like PDVSA, which is our main oil company. So the point is that it was part of this sort of, you know, huge ambitions, you know, motivated by this huge ego and what he called socialism of the 21st century, and part of it was extreme mismanagement. I mean, if you take into account that oil prices were never as high as they were with Chavez during the, 14, 15 years Chavez was in power. They were never as high. Venezuela never received that amount of wealth. And you see where we are now, numbers vary between 200 to 800 level of inflation. Then something went wrong. And basically what went wrong was that instead of diversifying the economy in ways that would allow the country to create wealth and employment, what he did basically was use the money politically. And he could do that because our central bank had no independence. Our judicial system had no independence. There was not a clear division of power, so he could do what he wanted with the money. So, yes, he was able to solve the issue of, I mean, to bring a lot of Venezuelans out of poverty. But what he didn't do was create the conditions for social mobility in the country. So as soon as the oil prices went down in the marketplace, partly because the United States increased production, partly because Saudi Arabia increased production, and all of a sudden the globe was flooded with oil, so the prices went down. Then all those projects became unsustainable, and Venezuela is back to square one in terms of poverty, even worse, because now we have less revenues, we have no money, the economy has not been diversified, so we are a port country, meaning that we import. Venezuelans import 90% of what they consume. And if you don't have the cash to import that, then you have the situation of a scarcity and the long lines that the country, that Venezuelans are facing nowadays in order to buy products as simple as milk and oil and medicine. You know, there are some, for instance, cardiovascular wards that had to close because they cannot treat people with heart problems because you need certain medicines and the country just doesn't have them and there's no money to buy them. Now, it is very paradoxical because at the same time, we're talking about a country that sits on top of a huge oil wealth, the largest oil reserves, proven oil reserves in the world, but we don't have the technology to extract that oil that has a lot of density. So it's as if it isn't there. And the company provided Venezuela with its oil revenue, PDVSA, which was before Chavez a corrupt company, but a functional company, a company that yielded a lot of revenues, it's broken as well. It's bankrupt. We are underproducing what we should produce. And also the intelligence, you know, that the country took decades in order to form an oil intelligence, you know, technical people who knew how to extract oil, who knew how to survey fields and determine where there is oil. A lot of those people have fled the country, and for the first time in the history of Venezuela, you know, there is an intellectual diaspora. So the situation now is very, 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 very critical. You know, even supporters of the Chavista revolution have kind of backtracked, like Noam Chomsky did when he wrote that letter. You know,
my guest is Pedro Longhi Froyon, and we're talking about the tragedy in Venezuela. This is a tragedy. I was reading that, you know, how Chavez just kicked out all the competent people running the oil business, all the people who really knew what they were doing, and substituted, as you indicated, camp followers, so to speak, who were totally incompetent.
Exactly. And the result of that is that, imagine, I mean, we're an old country, and that, I mean, that's important. Let me take a break here to say something. I mean, there has been a lot of works written on the way an oil economy has shaped the sort of collective imaginary of the country. There has never been in Venezuela since 1927, or since, you know, the emergence of oil in the political landscape of the country, there has never been in Venezuela, in the Venezuelan imaginary, in the Venezuelan psychology, a link between hard work and wealth, right? Because basically the government, you know, drilled a huge needle, extracted all this wealth, and then distributed the wealth. So it's a rentist economy. So that has also made up for a certain impatience in the country's collective imaginary. We want things to be solved now, right? We don't understand that impatience means that we don't understand the fact that in order to get or achieve a particular goal, you have to go through these particular stages. And when you have a collective that is that desperate, then we kind of can fall prey of these authoritarian figures, these caudillos. And we have throughout our history. I mean, Chavez is nothing new. He's new in his revolutionary rhetoric, so on and so forth, despite the fact that it was not a revolution like the Cuban Revolution. The means and modes of production, in that Marxist sense, did not change. They changed hands, but even our first commercial partner continued being the United States. Cuba was under an embargo by the United States, right? So it is very different there. But Chavez is not a new phenomenon. He's a caudillo, like Carlos Andrés Pérez was a caudillo, like ex-dictators were caudillos. I mean, this sort of authoritarian paternal figure with a sort of populist broad base appeal.
Well, Nicolas Maduro does not seem to kind of measure up to that in terms of personality and demonstrations of power and popular support. He seems to be kind of running from it.
No, definitely not. That's another thing, right? I mean, people blamed the international left, I would say. And I think this is an issue. I think the left should criticize itself. I am myself someone of leftist inclination, right? We should be critical when the left doesn't do well. And Maduro, everyone is ready to criticize Maduro. So am I. But Maduro is a consequence of something that I've been brewing for 15 years.
He didn't create it.
Yeah, exactly. And Chavez, before he went to Cuba to die, he knew he was going to die, right? He said, vote for this guy. And people voted for him. Now he has a 24% of popularity, and he's desperate. You see it in the way he's treated border issues with Colombia, sort of demolishing houses of migrant workers in the border of Venezuela and Colombia, marking their houses with, or spraying their houses with a deed, deported and demolished. So he's gone absolutely. Corruption, it began to brood in Chavez government. I mean, communist who was a university professor who was his minister of finance said, I can't work here anymore. And he wrote a public letter saying why he was renouncing his post. And basically he said there are $22 billion or $20 billion that are unaccounted for. Where are they?
Good question.
Yeah. And things have gotten worse. Of course, with Maduro, I mean, there are rumors that, you know, the Chavistas in powers, particularly one who is the president of the National Assembly, is in cahoot with drug dealers. The situation, the safety situation in Venezuela is appalling, right? Caracas, and people can look it up. It's between Caracas and San Pedro Sula in Honduras, which is a small city compared to Caracas. Caracas is a mega city. Caracas is the murder capital of the world. 82 people are killed by gunshot out of 100,000. 25,000 people died of gunshots.
It's been that way. Since last year, at least, when I first read that in the paper, Caracas being the most dangerous city to be in the world.
And it's been that way, Jeffrey, for a long, long time, right? But it's gotten worse. Now, going back to what you asked about Maduro, Maduro is not Chavez. I mean, that's clear. Chavez, he was very adept and very smart at sort of navigating the opposition, threatening the opposition without actually outright repressing them. So, or repressing it, or repressing discontent. You know, people could manifest, could protest in the street. With Maduro, something changed. You know, it's like a less polished Chavez. And he had, were protests 2 years ago. There were student protests, and he repressed them brutally. And not many countries in Latin America except Uruguay, spoke harshly against this horrible form of oppression. 40 students were killed. There are political prisoners. So this has become, and I'm very sad to say that, but this has become Chavez's legacy at this point. And there are elections in December. I think that the solution should be an electoral solution, a democratic solution, despite the fact that many Venezuelans, out of this sort of impatience and this despair that we talked about before, would like to see a military solution take place. And that isn't going to happen because the military has become an elite in the country, enjoying all the wealth that this government has looted from the Venezuelan people at the end.
Well, it doesn't sound like a very prospect. The prospects are bright for Venezuela. A number of people from the left will have said, well, the United States has been trying to undermine Venezuela and the Chavez government, and there's WikiLeaks cables that show all the contacts between the U.S. and the opposition. But from what you're saying, it didn't take the United States. This is not the fault of the United States. This is the fault of the incompetence of the Chavista government, which played into the United States' plans, but it wasn't something the United States was doing behind the scenes to destroy the Venezuelan economy.
The United States, along with other countries, they increased oil production. A number of oil-producing countries have suffered from that. But look at, for instance, comparatively, look at Nigeria. They have all kinds of other problems. They have been able to diversify their economy. But this situation, which we have people lining up to buy basic goods, this sort of demise of the middle class, this impoverishment of the country, this tremendous crisis with public safety. I mean, that's not the fault of the United States. And I don't doubt, for instance, that the United States foreign policy had a lot to do with the attempt, the coup d'etat, that Chavez suffered in 2002. Of course, it did. And I think the United States is, you know, exerts economic pressure not only on Venezuela and so many other countries, but the Chavismo or the Bolivarian Revolution or the Socialismo del siglo XXI, 21st century socialism, hasn't helped itself at all. You know, it's made things worse. I mean, we are the country with the highest rate of inflation in the world after Syria.
That's not a comparison a country wants to make, especially when there's no organized warfare on the streets.
Yeah. Something else that is interesting, right, which is a bit of a paradox if you think about it. You know, you have Chavez came into the political scene. It's almost as if he parachuted into the political scene of Venezuela without any sort of previous... I mean, he's an example of that kind of an impatience I'm talking about, without any sort of groundwork, or it was not a grassroots movement that propelled Chavez into the scene. The grassroots movement came afterwards, after he was in power, as opposed to, for instance, someone like Lula, who was part of the Workers' Party in Brazil, for the leader of the Working Party in Brazil for 20, 25 years. So that sort of coherent platform that a political party gives you, and that kind of works or helps in deterring authoritarian tendencies, you know, when you owe yourself to a party within a political process that is democratic, so on and so forth, Chavez didn't have.
It's around one man. Well, we have come to the end of a very interesting discussion. My guest, Pedro Lange-Choyon, thank you so much for being our guest.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Yes, it was our pleasure. Thanks so much. We'll look forward to doing it again after the elections.
Wonderful.
Take care.
Take care, Jeffrey. Bye.